Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Beth, and I'll be reading you today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 18th. We start with the weather and the lottery. Pretty decent week shaping up. Temperatures for the most part in the mid to high 40s. Today mostly sunny, high 49. Tomorrow partly sunny, potentially a little bit of showers in the area, but still 47. Wednesday high 48, clouds and occasional sunshine. And Thursday high 45, partial sun. Friday the temp drops a bit with a high of only 41. Taking a look at some lottery numbers from the weekend. The numbers game, yesterday's midday drawing for Sunday, March 17th, 4498. And Sunday night's numbers game drawing, 2531. Sunday mass cash, 11, 13, 14, 25, and 27. And Saturday's Powerball number was 12, 23, 44, 57, 61, Powerball 5. First front page story in this headline, investors weren't told the whole story. A four-bedroom house in Chatham is involved in a Denver District Court complaint against a Colorado-based company that offers co-ownership of luxury vacation homes on Cape Cod and other coveted destinations. Founded in 2013, Lifestyle Asset Group's business model centers on forming multiple limited liability companies, or LLCs, and selling membership interest to investors before using those funds to purchase vacation homes. That's according to a lawsuit filed on November 30th by Colorado Securities Commissioner Tung Chan. Investors were told that the properties would be sold after a certain term period, and the profits from the sale would be distributed among them, and that money would be refunded if a property did not raise its minimum investment. Instead, the plan evolved into a complicated, decade-long, expansive property investment scheme, Chan told the Times in an email statement. Lifestyle Asset Group is alleged to have misled investors about amounts raised, loans, undisclosed side deals, the properties, and other information when it struggled to make up gaps in financing, according to the complaint. We allege the investors weren't told the whole story before investing, that there were material misrepresentations and omissions, and that it is not only unfair to investors, but also against the law, Chan told the Times. Lifestyle Asset Group co-founders Richard Keith, Tommy Robinson, and Carla Jones are also listed as defendants. Lifestyle Asset Group and Carla Jones did not respond to requests for comment. Jeffrey Thomas, an attorney with Linden Law Partners in Denver, listed as the top lawyer representing the defendants, could not be reached for comment through email or phone. As of Thursday, a judge had not yet ruled on a motion to dismiss filed by the defendants on February 2nd, according to the clerk's office at the district court. The Times has filed a public records request with the court for copies of the motion to dismiss and other records. A ruling by a judge was also not available on Chan's request for an injunction to prevent Lifestyle Asset Management and its entities from violations of the Colorado Securities Act. The clerk's office said that decision would likely come when the case is ultimately resolved. Lifestyle Asset Group and its affiliates have received at least $10.9 million in principal payments and have repaid about $3.3 million, according to Chan's lawsuit. Now, the Chatham House at 73 Roland Drive is highlighted in the complaint as an instance where the company allegedly failed to abide by the terms outlined in its offering documents to investors. Lifestyle Cape Cod, an entity set up by Lifestyle Group Asset, offered sales of shares in its LLC priced between $50,000 and $165,000 per share, according to a March 30th, 2020 document cited by Chan. The document set the minimum investor total at $2,950,000 and the max as $3,230,000. The purpose was to buy the 2,450-square-foot house with 4 bedrooms and 5.5 bathrooms. Nestled on a quiet dead-end street, the house overlooks picturesque Frost Fish Creek and sits at the end of a long, winding driveway. LLC members would be able to book vacations at the home and could book stays at properties in the Elite Alliance timeshare network for an additional fee, according to the complaint. Lifestyle Cape Cod purchased 73 Roland Drive without having the money on hand or meeting its minimum as outlined in its offering documents, the complaint alleges. On April 3, 2020, Lifestyle Cape Cod bought 73 Roland Drive for $1 from Mark William Johnson and Jane Clayson Johnson, trustees of the Mark William Johnson 2010 Revocable Trust, according to Barnstable County Registry of Deeds records. The sellers accepted $2.6 million worth of shares in Lifestyle Cape Cod without paying for the shares, reads the complaint. This was not a bona fide sale of interests, and the offset was not disclosed to investors, according to the complaint. A notice of sale of securities filed on April 14, 2020, with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission states that $470,000 of the $3 million offering had been sold. Eventually, Lifestyle Cape Cod paid the sellers just under $1.6 million after obtaining money from later investors in Lifestyle Cape Cod and reduced the number of shares held by the sellers accordingly, Chan alleges. The house at 73 Roland Drive was renovated from the studs in 2018 by Dennis-based Reef Builders, according to Lifestyle Asset Group. The house was originally overhauled for resale on the regular market, said Reef Builders President Matt Teague to the Times in an email, but the owners pursued the fractional ownership option when the house would not sell after a year or so. In a website post about the sale dated April 9, 2020, Lifestyle Asset Group said the company had paved the way so a family from Iowa was able to invest in a gorgeous $2,700,000 Chatham Cape Cod vacation property for just $470,000. The complaint also names other alleged instances, such as a New York City property where management had fallen behind on condo fees that the property was foreclosed on. In most cases, investors were told properties would be purchased outright and own them free and clear of debt, but many of the properties were, in fact, encumbered by undisclosed mortgages or loans, Chan alleges. As Cape Cod and the islands continue to navigate a housing crisis, some local officials worry that the trend of fractional ownership could place further stress on its housing supply and make it harder for year-round residents to secure housing. Some municipalities have restricted or banned fractional ownership in their communities, such as Provincetown and Tisbury. Nantucket and Edgartown are expected to vote on the issue at town meetings this spring, and Truro and Eastham are now also mulling town meeting articles to ban that particular business model. And if you haven't filed your taxes yet, you might be interested in this story. A new Internal Revenue Service direct file tax filing program could save the average Massachusetts taxpayer 9 hours of prep time and $160, according to Senator Elizabeth Warren. The program would lift what U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat from the 7th, called a fundamental burden facing almost every American adult. It's free, secure, and there are no upsells, she said. The two joined White House National Economic Council Director Lael Brainard in a press call Friday to get the word out to an estimated 850,000 eligible Massachusetts taxpayers that the program was available. Brainard estimated the total savings in filing fees for Massachusetts taxpayers could amount to $136 million annually. Tim Hugo, executive director of the Free File Alliance, claims that about 100 million Americans are eligible for the IRS Free File, but only 3% used it last year. DirectFile launched March 12th in 12 states and is estimated to cover roughly one-third of people's tax situations in participating states. It is a free tax filing program for eligible taxpayers. Now, that eligibility is based on several factors, including income amounts and the types of deductions and tax credits claimed. The push for a free government tax filing program dates back to President Ronald Reagan in 1985, Warren said. At the time, he called for a return-free tax system for taxpayers with simple returns. But big tax preparation companies have spent millions lobbying against the concept, she said. Several companies do offer free tax preparation services, including TurboTax, H&R Block, FreeTax USA, Cash App Taxes, TaxSlayer, and TaxAct. All of them have eligibility requirements. About 36 million people filed their taxes with TurboTax last year, and an estimated 10 million filed with H&R Block, TaxAct, and TaxSlayer, according to Warren. Tanya Mercado, senior communications manager with Intuit, the global financial tech company, said in a December 8th interview that DirectFile is not free, that it will cost taxpayers billions. The IRS receives $78 billion in Inflation Reduction Act funds to improve the IRS services, beef up its enforcement, and start the free file program. More than 124 million people have used Intuit's free tax prep software in the last decade, she said. Individuals with simple returns earning no more than $73,000 were eligible last year. Mercado said the government is spending money on the program when private companies are already providing the free service. But ads for free services have not been all they appeared, according to Warren. A ProPublica report last year said the FTC found Intuit tricked millions of Americans into paying to file their taxes when they should have been able to do so for free. If a tax company is truly giving it away for free, why would they object? Warren said. The Federal Trade Commission is challenging H&R Block on the claim that the company is deleting consumers' tax data when they downgrade to a more affordable online product. Another concern is the personal information collected by the tax prep companies through Meta, Pixel, and Google tools embedded in their websites, according to an investigation led by Warren and six other lawmakers in 2023. It's illegal to release tax information, Warren said. The DirectFile program, if you're interested, is available in English and Spanish at directfile.irs.gov. The interview-based service works on smartphones, laptops, tablets, and desktop computers. And this story from The Vineyard. A Massachusetts appeal court decision was made in the favor of Vineyard Conservation Society on Thursday after a December 5th hearing was held to determine ownership of 5.7 acres of land in Gay Head. The land, also known as Lot 240, has been the center of a seven-year-long court case between Vineyard Conservation Society and the Devine family. Court deliberations stretch back to May 2017, when a complaint was filed by Vineyard Conservation Society to decipher who Lot 240 was deeded to in 1870. Tanisha Gomes, one of 19 defendants in the case, said the deed that includes Lot 240 was fraudulent and legally passed to the defendants through their ancestor, Louisa Pocknett Devine. The Conservation Society bases its claim of ownership on 1944 and 45 deeds, which the Society says show that Horace Devine, Louisa Pocknett Devine's grandson, gave Henry Kronig, a real estate company owner in the mid-1900s, the entirety of his family's land, including Lot 240. Kronig founded Kronig's Real Estate in 1917, according to the company website. The company is based in Vineyard Haven. "We haven't had time to process the ruling," Gomes said on Friday to the Times. Marlene Devine, another defendant in the case, said the appeals court judges weren't well-versed in land court cases. "It's disappointing that the appeals court didn't do their due diligence," she said. Attorney Jonathan Poloni, who argued for the Define family, called the case an uphill fight on Friday and said he had been hoping for a different outcome. "It was a bit of a long shot, but in my heart I was hoping that common sense would prevail." Vineyard Conservation Society Board President Jennifer Bloom declined to comment Saturday and referred questions to Executive Director Samantha Look, and she didn't respond to requests for comment either. In the decision, appeals court judges said that the Divine ancestors, who were Wampanoag, made their intentions to give up claims to land located on Gay Head clear. During the December hearing, Associate Justice Kenneth Desmond Jr. peppered Poloni with questions about the language of the deed. Gomes told The Times in 2022 that, from her perspective, the 1944 and 45 deeds specify lots that were sold to Kronig by Horace Divine with a certain dollar value attached, but Lot 240 was never named or described in either deed, she said. "There is language in the deed where Horace states, 'All my land in Gay Head,' which Vineyard Conservation says includes Lot 240, she said. "But because Lot 240 isn't named on that deed, it's hard to say that Horace gave it away. I don't believe he gave all his land away in Gay Head." While Lot 240 wasn't specifically named on any of the deeds associated with the transaction between Horace Divine and Henry Kronig, said Poloni, the court chose not to ignore a deed interpretation, which he said was based on broad, expansive language. "That was the hump we couldn't get over," said Poloni. The Conservation Society, said Poloni, also already had a claim to the land through an alternative chain of title, and the Divines, he said, weren't able to establish who the owner should be, other than referring to Divine heirs in a general sense, said Poloni. "The Divine family hasn't made a claim on the land for a very long time," said Poloni. "That meant the case was coming up in an unusual way. The Divine family is welcome to enter an appeal to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court," said Poloni. "They aren't obligated to take on an appeal just because one isn't filed, though," he said of the court generally. Since 1945, Lot 240 has passed through several layers of ownership, eventually landing in the hands of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis in 1978. In 2022, Gomes told The Times that Lot 240 was included in a 2013 gift deed between Caroline Kennedy, Jacqueline Kennedy's daughter, and the Vineyard Conservation Society. According to gift deed documents provided by Gomes, the Kennedy family, through its Redgate Farm LLC, donated 30 acres of its Aquinnah property to the Conservation Society. The land, which was valued at $3.7 million, was gifted for $10, according to the documents. In 2017, Gomes received a letter from Fidelity National Law Group to inform her and the other defendants about title questions with the land. The letter informed Gomes and her relatives that a lawsuit was filed in Dukes County Superior Court against the family. Pocknet Divine is described in the complaint as the former owner of the property. She died in 1874 and was a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. The family members were asked to sign an agreement to verify they had no right, title, or interest in Lot 240, which was indicated on a plan entitled Plan of Gay Head. After further research, Gomes and her family found that Lot 240 remained in Divine Pocknet's name on the Town of Aquinnah Assessor Department website and objected to the lawsuit due to what the family believes was discrepancies surrounding incomplete deeds for Lot 240. "The name on the assessor website changed," said Gomes, after the December 5th appeals court hearing. "The case is important because of how land has been manipulated away from Wampanoag families over time," she said. "There are Wampanoag families across the Cape and Islands who continue to fight for sovereignty and land, which was lost through colonization, and in this case, title fraud," said Gomes. "If our family won this latest case, it would have had an impact on land in Aquinnah that should be custodially be held by Wampanoag people." In other news, a 17-year-old Nantucket teenager is dead after a crash on the island, according to police. Nantucket police said in a press release around 10:30 p.m. Saturday that they received several 911 calls for what sounded like a motor vehicle crash in the area of Bartlett Road. Police found a 2024 white Dodge Promaster van had crashed into a berm at the end of the road. The van was upright on top of the berm and the front was damaged. The driver, who was the only occupant, was dead behind the wheel when officers arrived, according to police. Relatives of the teenager have been notified. Police say they will not release further information about the person's identity due to their age. In a statement provided to the Times, Nantucket Public Schools confirmed the teenager was a Nantucket High School student. Once again, our small community island faces heartbreak and grief with the passing of one of our Nantucket High School students in a fatal car accident late last night, reads the statement. We are terribly saddened by this tragedy and the unexpected loss of such a young life. School officials will not release the name of the student at this time out of respect for the family. Counseling and translation support will be available at the high school on Monday and in the following days for students and staff. Counselors and translators at each of the other schools will also be available for any students or staff who need additional support. There were no witnesses to the crash, nor was there any evidence of any other vehicle or persons involved, reads the press release from police. The cause of the crash remains under investigation. However, there was evidence that speed was a factor in the crash. And here's what you need to know about the controlled burn that's happening today, Monday, at Camp Edwards. The Massachusetts National Guard will conduct a prescribed burn today on Cape Edwards on Joint Base Cape Cod, starting mid-morning and continuing until about 5 p.m. The Guard said its main objectives of the controlled burn are reducing the risk of fires fed by wildland, ecological pine barrens management, and wildland firefighter training. Camp Edwards, home to over 37 state-listed species of plants and animals, undergoes prescribed burns to duplicate the role natural fire plays in maintaining a mosaic of ecological communities, according to the National Guard. And here's today's column written by Steve Heeslip, who is the chief photographer for the Cape Cod Times. And he writes, and the headline is, Hyannis Wedding of Maria Shriver to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He writes, 90% of life is showing up. That quote is attributed to Woody Allen. The percentage is debatable. For the wandering photojournalist, showing up is easy. Where to stand when you get there is the hard part, especially in crowds. Jockeying my way around the Cape Cod St. Patrick's Parade last week, I remembered my first big crowd lesson, April 26, 1986, the Hollywood in Hyannis wedding of Maria Shriver to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Wedding day Saturday was a sight probably not seen on South Street in Hyannis since JFK headed to the armory to give his speech after winning the 1960 presidential election. A rope line kept crowds away from all the entrances to St. Francis Xavier Church. Straight across from the church, on the sidewalk, was a set of risers for the media, and then crowds filled in the intersection of South Street and High School Road. Media staging was on a first-come basis, so even hours ahead, just about every spot was taken. I selected a spot right of center to the church entryway and about halfway up the risers. There are many decisions made when you choose your spot. Too far left or right of the entrance can spell disaster. A high vantage point can help photograph over cars and stray people in the way, but too high and faces become top-of-head portraits. Standing spot selected, next up, the waiting game. Leave your spot and it's gone. This was before cell phones. Killing time involved talking to your new best friend media neighbors. After hours of boredom, it's showtime. Celebrities arrive, side views and backs of heads into church. Once the ceremony starts, wait time again. But you must stay ready, in this case, long after the service started, Andy Warhol and model Grace Jones arrived very late. The real reward for selecting a good spot comes as the crowd pours out onto the street. Now everyone is facing the camera. Tabloid journalists are yelling questions, and the famous couple are front and center. Arnold presents his bride, and camera motor drives burn through film. My spot, just to the right, provided a good angle. Beginner's luck. Many years later, it's still a gamble where to stand. Thankfully for a parade, the choice is easy, either side of the street. Miss the shot, simply race ahead of the marchers, and try again. And again, that's a column written by Cape Cod Times chief photographer Steve Heaslip. This headline, Family Struggle with Rental Assistant Rules and Regs. Anna Smith has applied three times to the state's Rental Assistance for Families in Transition program, before, during, and after COVID, with the intention of saving her two kids and her life. Little did she anticipate the outcome would take a detour. January marked the third rejection for the 28-year-old Springfield resident. The Massachusetts Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities turned down her request for assistance in relocating to a new home, saying that their mission has shifted back to include helping both homeowners and renters, so a renter must prove a legitimate need to move, for example, an inability to pay rent or a threatened eviction by their current landlord. Smith fell short of their standards. It's not like it was during COVID, said Smith, who was fired from her job in a restaurant in 2020 and relocated to a new but horrible home after reapplying and using her rental assistance voucher. It was also really helpful when I first applied for it. The Healey administration's state fiscal 2025 budget included an overall increase for the rental assistance program. But policy changes effective last July extended the program to homeowners and reduced the maximum amount of benefits a household can receive over a 12-month period from $10,000 down to $7,000. In addition, successful applicants will no longer be eligible to receive reimbursement for any expected rental costs other than current debts or arrears. Generous benefits had to adjust to help more because people in demands are increasing, said Keith Ferry, who's the chief financial officer of Wayfinders, a nonprofit housing administration organization that serves Western Mass residents. According to state data, the agency served approximately 40,000 households through the rental assistance program from the beginning of 2020 to the end of March 23, with Springfield only second to Boston in need. Since the end of the pandemic, fewer applications are being submitted due to the complexity of the forms, dropping from over 6,700 to almost 3,400. Landlords typically are unwilling to wait too long after they have discovered a property, and since the rental assistance application needs their signature and participation, many of them initially reject lessees who are funded by the state program. It was so hard to find even a landlord who would sign, said Smith, and often they required you to pay three times the rent to hold the house. Massachusetts ranks as the third least affordable state in the U.S. for housing, behind only California and Hawaii. For 2020, an employee would need to make $35.52 per hour in order to afford a two-bedroom rental property at the fair market rent of $1,800 without having to spend more than 30% of their salary on housing. However, as of May 2022, the mean hourly income was $36.83, and the median wage for all occupations was only $28, indicating that at least half of the households are unable to lead secure lives. Fair market rent keeps rising. How much would they have to earn per hour if they are working 40 hours a week to afford an apartment? Said Kelly Turley, the Springfield Area Associate Director of the Mass Coalition for the Homeless. Massachusetts is consistently unaffordable, Turley added. Advocates claim that even if the monthly subsidy was back to $10,000, it would still be insufficient for larger families or households in locations with more expensive real estate. $7,000 is not enough, said Turley. The majority of rental assistance applicants requested financing because they received notice to quit or eviction from their landlords. Others were experiencing financial hardship due to layoffs. Can you imagine hundreds of people facing eviction every day when you sit on the housing court, said Smith. Massachusetts saw legislative efforts last year to make some eviction protections permanent, particularly through the reenactment of and calls for extension of Chapter 257, a law originally intended to halt eviction cases for tenants who had applications for rental assistance pending. The goal was to protect renters and increase landlords' rental aid payouts. What happens then if the defendant's outstanding balance is more than the current benefit cap could sponsor, say $8,000, and they don't have access to any other resources to cover the difference, Turley asked. Even though the rental assistance application is still pending, the judge would likely proceed with the eviction. We will continue to advocate to raise that cap to go back to a minimum of $10,000 and to push for more flexibility to help people and save lives, said Turley. So this is the halfway point of the broadcast, and I will now read today's obituaries. Deanna Cowan Cryan, age 65, of Centerville, peacefully departed on February 26, surrounded by loved ones. Deanna Marie Cowan was born on April 14, 1958, in Mount Vernon, Washington, to Donna and Hayward Cohen, and spent her early years in Marble Mount, Washington. In 1962, the family moved to Renton, Washington, where she attended Kent schools. During her childhood years, Deanna began drawing and painting classes and developed a lasting passion for the visual arts. In 1976, Deanna graduated from Kentridge Senior High and chose Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, to attend college. She majored in interior design, graduating in 1980 with a Bachelor of Arts degree. Deanna made several lifelong friends during her years at Western. Deanna began her career as an interior designer working in Seattle with a focus on commercial design. She won a contest sponsored by Knoll International and later accepted a position at their offices in New York City, where she moved in 1982. Soon after moving to New York in 1983, Deanna met the love of her life, Richard Dick Cryan, fresh out of Columbia University's business school. Dick and Deanna were married in 1984 in Renton, Washington, and moved to Boston later that year, where they started their family. Jonathan Arthur Cryan was born in 1991, and Madeline Joyce Cryan in November 92. Deanna and Dick bought their first home in Needham and lived in multiple communities in the Boston Metro West area for several years. Deanna redesigned and landscaped four different homes. The family regularly attended church services wherever they lived, most currently as members of St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Barnstable. Deanna had a warm smile and a hearty laugh and made friends fast in all her communities. She was an accomplished artist who had her paintings accepted in many shows. In addition to her skills in painting and interior design, she later added landscape design and gardening to her passions. Dick and Deanna retired to Cape Cod in 2018, where her gardening skills flourished and where she forged many strong new friendships. She bravely took on growing dahlias in recent years, and the garden and its new growth will remain a source of joy to her husband Dick and their friends and families. Deanna passed away on February 26 from acute myeloid leukemia. Deanna's family would like to thank the care teams at Dana-Farber, Brigham and Women's, V&A Hospice and Palliative Care of Cape Cod, and Lighthouse Home Health Care of Cape Cod for the excellent and kind care received, especially during Deanna's final days. She is survived by her husband Dick, her children Jonathan and Madeline, her sister Joyce Cowan, her mother Donna Cowan, and the family's beloved cat, Mackie. Deanna will be greatly missed by all who knew her. A memorial service will be held at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Barnstable Village on Saturday, April 6 at 11 a.m., reception following. Margaret Ann Pratt Alex, 96, died Saturday, March 16th at the Notre Dame Long-Term Care Center in Worcester. Her husband, Arthur Alex, died in 1987. She leaves her four children, Suzanne Lockhart of Huntington Beach, California, Brian of Westport, Connecticut, Marianne Finn of Grafton, and Charles Alex of Sudbury. Six grandchildren, two great-grandchildren, and siblings Paul Pratt, Helen Morin, and Jane O'Leary. Margaret worked as a nurse in Memorial Hospital, UMass Medical Center, and Boston Children's Hospital. She also taught art classes in the Auburn Public Schools and Assumption Prep. After her husband's passing, she moved to West Dennis. Calling hours will take place Wednesday, March 20th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Athey Memorial Home, 111 Lancaster Street in Worcester. The funeral will be held Thursday, March 21st with a mass at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of the Rosary Church, 25 Fales Street in Worcester, and burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery in Worcester. Back to the news in this headline, third-party voters could decide race. Independents could have the final word in November. In any tight race, the unaffiliated can be the difference. Pew Research analysis shows that former President Trump narrowly won over independents in his 2016 victory over Hillary Clinton, while President Biden earned the majority of their vote in his 2020 win. Significant shifts within the independent ranks, which include first-time voter Joshua Summers, could be consequential this year. "I'm a stubborn person," said Summers, a 20-year-old University of Pittsburgh mechanical engineering major who was interning with an organization in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. "I wanted to go with something I felt was the best representation of my beliefs. I'm very happy to vote Democrat for one office and Republican for the next." Someone like Summers would be tough to fit into a neat stereotype. He leans left with his concerns about climate change, yet feels more aligned with the right on the culture wars and immigration. He's also troubled by a perceived lack of interest among the political class in anti-corruption reforms, such as cracking down on insider trading. "There's no one who's really pushing for good government," Summers said. "I want people who are conscious that our democracy is imperfect and are trying to improve it. There's a lot of other countries that have better democratic systems than ours." More broadly, there are early signs that independents are opening up to the Republican Party again after a few years of big wins for the Democrats. Economist/YouGov polling from January indicates that a plurality of independents, 19%, see inflation and prices as the most important issue facing Americans. Independents' concerns align more closely with Republicans at this juncture, with both demographics listing inflation, prices, and immigration as their two top issues. "It does look like Trump has gained with this group," said Carl Bialik, YouGov's America's U.S. Politics editor. He noted that approximately 71% of independents seem to have made up their minds, with 41% leaning towards Trump, 30% towards Biden, and 10% vowing to refuse to vote. Still, a sizable chunk of unaffiliated voters may still be in play, with 11% planning to vote for a third candidate and 9% unsure. That's a group that could go for a third-party candidate. Also, a lot of them haven't decided yet and could end up in Biden or Trump's camp. "I'm a lifelong Republican," said 79-year-old Vietnam vet Chuck Zitnik, "and frankly, the Republican Party left me." He's conflicted in many ways. He's a Catholic who's against abortion and wants to reduce the spending that it's increased the national debt. The only time he went Democratic in a presidential race was a 1972 anti-war vote for George McGovern. In 2016 and 2020, he voted for Libertarian Party nominees, but he said he's disgusted enough by the bully, misogynist GOP frontrunner to strongly consider the Democrat incumbent. "I think it's over the Republicans unless they make major changes," he said. "We need the younger people. In the coming election, I'll probably vote for Biden because I can't stand Trump." And this headline, forecasters say La Nina could worsen hurricane season. La Nina is still on track to form this year, government forecasters announced last week, given the climate pattern a 62% chance of developing during the upcoming summer months. Among other impacts, the emergence of La Nina could boost the severity of the Atlantic hurricane season. Forecasters also reported that the recent strong El Niño is weakening and expected to transition to enzo-neutral conditions over the next few months. The entire El Niño-La Niña cycle is known as the El Niño-Southern Oscillation. Its three phases, El Niño, La Niña, and enzo-neutral, can affect weather in the U.S. and around the world. Overall, forecasters at the Climate Prediction Center place odds on a milder and drier than average spring across most of the country. La Niña is a natural climate pattern marked by cooler than average seawater in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean. It is one of the main drivers of weather in the U.S., especially during the late fall, winter, and early spring. It's the opposite of the more well-known El Niño, which occurs when Pacific Ocean water is warmer than average. Signs of La Niña are starting to be seen in the Pacific. We're starting to see hints of cooling at the surface in a small region of the eastern Pacific. La Niña can contribute to an increase in Atlantic hurricane activity by weakening the wind shear over the Caribbean Sea and tropical Atlantic Basin, which enables storms to develop and intensify. Vertical wind shear refers to the change in wind speed and direction between roughly 5,000 and 35,000 feet above the ground. Strong vertical wind shear can rip a developing hurricane apart or even prevent it from forming. This is what can happen during El Niño when Atlantic hurricane activity is often suppressed. La Niña typically has minimal impact on U.S. weather in the summer other than the effect on hurricanes. Winter is the one season in which they have the most impact. A typical La Niña winter in the U.S. brings cold and snow to the northwest and unusually dry conditions to most of the nation's southern tier. The southeast and mid-Atlantic also tend to see warmer than average temperatures during a La Niña winter. Meanwhile, New England and the upper Midwest into New York tend to see colder than average temperatures, the Weather Channel said. In other news, Princess Kate's photo editing scandal has caused photo service AFP to reconsider Kensington Palace as a trusted source. Formerly known as Agence France-Presse, the agency issued a kill notification shortly after it was discovered that the family photo showing Catherine seated on a chair and surrounded by her children had been subject to manipulation. The Associated Press and Reuters did the same. Phil Chetwin, the global news director of AFP, told BBC Radio 4's The Media Show on Wednesday that the agency decided to kill the photo due to glaring editing issues and Kensington Palace's failure to respond to a request for the original image. "We didn't get a reply, which is why we killed the photo," he said. Killing a photo on the basis of manipulation is a rare occurrence that happens once a year, maybe, I hope, less. When asked if AFP still considered the palace a trusted source, Chetwin said, "No, absolutely not. Like with anything, when you're let down by a source, the bar is raised. It's actually not even very well photoshopped. There's clearly a lot of issues with the photo," Chetwin said. "It shouldn't have been validated. I think as soon as it was, all of the photo editors at all of the major agencies immediately saw there was a problem and got together and spoke about it and said, what do we do?" He added, "We sent out notes to all our teams at the moment to be absolutely super more vigilant about the content coming across our desk, even from what we would call trusted sources." In a Monday morning post from the Prince and Princess of Wales account on X, formerly Twitter, Kate apologized and took the blame. "Like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing, the post read. "I want to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused. I hope everyone celebrating had a very happy Mother's Day." The publicity mess only heightened speculation about the Prince's condition, who hasn't been seen since Christmas Day. She underwent that planned abdominal surgery on January 16th and has remained out of the public eye since. Here's today's Ask Carolyn column with the headline, "Parent Embarrassed That College Grad Son is a Bartender." "Dear Carolyn, My son is a college graduate with a job as a bartender. I get embarrassed telling people what he does when they ask. Help me. Signed, embarrassed. Dear embarrassed, he's a bartender. Just say it. Shoulders squared. Fake it till you feel it. It's real work, and I'm glad and grateful for everyone who's good at it. Half the people you tell will envy him. 100% won't care as much as you do. The slim minority who judge him as beneath them are jerks. And anyone who stops a moment to think about it knows that a college degree isn't just about getting a so-called professional job. It's also about learning how to think critically and how to be part of a diverse and interesting community and how to challenge oneself. All of these are available outside the college experience, obviously. Plus, people can get through college successfully while achieving zero mind expansion. But mind expansion is, in fact, the commonly accepted point of an education. Being embarrassed just tells people you don't get this. So, instead, be proud your son did the work and be proud he's finding his own way in the world. I hope you take this reader's thought to heart. Dear embarrassed, please rethink this attitude. I guarantee your son is picking up on it and putting unnecessary pressure on himself to succeed by your terms. I had parents like that, where I was instilled to believe that things like waiting tables and bartending were beneath me, so when I graduated, I had so much anxiety that I didn't have a real job. Instead of doing something sensible and just waiting tables or doing odd jobs until I figured it out, I ended up applying to graduate school for a master's degree I didn't care about and was completely unprepared for. I ended up $50,000 in debt because I grew up in a household that didn't respect work that wasn't a 9-to-5. Please don't do this to your children. Another question is, Dear Carolyn, my in-laws never say thank you. My husband has noticed this himself. How should I deal? Signed, No Thank You. Dear No Thank You, deal by knowing they don't say thank you and will never say thank you, and relieving yourself of the burden of any expectation that they will ever say thank you. People are weird. This is their weird. Roll with it. Assure yourself they are thanking you deeply in their hearts. Dear Carolyn, my husband and I have become friends with another couple over the last year. We like them both individually a lot. They're funny, interesting people. But particularly when we're at their house, the dynamic between them is tense. They harshly critique the other's decisions and tastes a lot, and they appeal to us to choose a side, even over small stuff. This week, for instance, one bought a chair the other denounced as ugly, and they put my husband on the spot to decide who's right. How do we graciously decline to be pulled into their spats, signed Out of the Middle? Dear Out of the Middle, no way, not our fight. Could solve so many problems at once. And here's some of what's on television tonight at 8 p.m. on Fox. It's MasterChef Junior. The chefs are up for their first team challenge in which they are tasked with preparing hearty meals for the Harlem Globetrotters. On NBC at 8 p.m., it's The Voice. The battle rounds begin as the coaches prepare their artists to go head-to-head in dueling duets. On NBC at 10 p.m., it's Deal or No Deal Island. The elusive banker aims to assess whether one of the remaining 10 players can bluff their way into securing the highest value briefcase, bringing them closer to the largest prize in Deal or No Deal history. And from Boston, while some American cities celebrated St. Patrick's Day a day early this weekend, Boston, one of the most Irish cities in the country, held its parades and festivities on Sunday, or March 17th. Crowds of green-clad revelers lined the streets for the South Boston St. Patrick's Day parade, which typically draws about 1 million people. It not only celebrates the city's Irish heritage, but also Evacuation Day, commemorating the evacuation of British troops from Boston during the Revolutionary War. When Aidan Richardson began attending school in Worcester, Mass., friends insisted they had to attend the Boston Parade. "It's a great time so far," said the native of Rochester, New York. "When I grew up, I was told I was Irish. Then all of a sudden last year I found out I was Scottish, but I still love it." In Washington, President Joe Biden held a St. Patrick's Day brunch for Catholic leaders in the East Room on Sunday. The room was decked out for the holiday with an Irish flag, shamrocks, and green and gold tablecloths. Guest seating cards were written in Celtic-looking green lettering. Biden, a devout Catholic who was exceedingly proud of his Irish heritage, told Ireland's prime minister, who was also in attendance, that he was grateful for spending time with him on the holiday, and he thanked the Catholic workers for their humanitarian work. The president also hosted a reception later Sunday. In Boston, other St. Patrick's Day events were also taking place around the city, including a memorial mass and a boxing tournament. Long-running Boston punk band Dropkick Murphys was set to play the first of its back-to-back St. Patrick's Day concerts. In some other news, a charter flight carrying dozens of U.S. citizens fleeing spiraling gang violence in Haiti landed Sunday in Miami, U.S. State Department officials said. More than 30 U.S. citizens were on the government-chartered flight. It arrived in the Miami International Airport after the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince earlier this month urged U.S. citizens to leave as soon as possible as chaos grips Haiti. Haiti's main airport in Port-au-Prince remains closed following gang attacks that have raged through Haiti for weeks, pushing many people to the brink of famine. The State Department announced Saturday that it would offer limited charter flights for American citizens from the less chaotic northern city of Cap Haitien. Officials said they could not provide ground transportation to that airport and that U.S. citizens should consider the charter flights only if you think you can reach the airport safely. The U.S. military last week flew in additional forces to bolster security at the U.S. Embassy, which is in a neighborhood largely controlled by gangs. And a second man from St. Paul, Minnesota, has been charged in connection with the 2005 theft of a pair of ruby slippers that Judy Garland wore in The Wizard of Oz, according to an indictment unsealed on Sunday. Jerry Hal Sliderman, 76, of Crystal, was charged with theft of a major artwork and witness tampering. He did not enter a plea when he made his first court appearance Friday. The slippers, adorned with sequins and glass beads, were stolen from the Judy Garland Museum in the late actor's hometown of Grand Rapids, Minnesota, nearly 20 years ago, and their whereabouts remained a mystery until the FBI recovered them in 2018. The indictment says Sliderman knew they were stolen and that he threatened to release a sex tape of a woman and take her down with him if she didn't keep her mouth shut about the slippers. Sliderman was in a wheelchair and on supplemental oxygen during his Friday court appearance. His oxygen machine hummed throughout the hearing, and he bounced his knee nervously during breaks in the proceedings. The man who stole the slippers, Terry John Martin, 76, pleaded guilty in October to theft of a major artwork, admitting to using a hammer to smash the glass of the museum's door and display case in what his attorney said was an attempt to pull off one last score after turning away from a life of crime. He was sentenced in January to time served because of his poor health. And very briefly, in sports, the brackets have been built for the upcoming college basketball NCAA tournaments. And in the men's side, UConn, Purdue, Houston, and North Carolina get top seeding. And on the women's side, it's South Carolina, Iowa, USC, and Texas women landing the number one seeds. In this headline, Rutgers researchers cast doubt on maternal death surge. For years, physicians and public health officials have been flummoxed and embarrassed by alarming stats showing the U.S. maternal death rate surging over two decades, far outpacing rates in other wealthy nations. Now a team of researchers, including those at Rutgers Health, say the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has sharply overstated the maternal death rate through faulty surveillance techniques. The rate is actually in line with similar nations, according to a study published Tuesday in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. It's important to set the record straight, said Cand Aneth, chief of Division of Epidemiology and Biostats at Rutgers. Officials estimate Official estimates show maternal death rates nearly doubling between 2018 and 2021, which clearly hasn't happened. Still, many media outlets have reported these figures as correct. A CDC press officer did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A USA Today analysis of data ranked New Jersey fifth worst in the nation with 36.2 maternal deaths per 100,000 births. That was from 2012 through 2016. It ranked 14 a few years later with a maternal death rate of 24.1 per 100,000 births, but those stats may be far off according to the new study. Maternal death rates nearly tripled over the last two decades and surged in recent years to 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2021, up from 2018 and 2007. The new study says the U.S. rate is actually slightly more than 10 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. Despite the better outcomes overall, the researchers still found a wide racial gap. Black women still had the highest maternal death rate at 23.8 per 100,000 live births. Those racial gaps are persistent in New Jersey, where black women lead the state in maternal death rate, along with obstetric hemorrhage and hypertension during childbirth. The study's authors say the problem with the CDC numbers lies with the way statistics are gathered. The maternal death rates began to rise in 2003 when a pregnancy checkbox was first put on U.S. death certificates. The CDC's National Vital Statistics System changed the rules on the checkbox, but still classifies many non-maternal deaths as a direct result of their pregnancy. If you're pregnant and die in a car crash, that's not a maternal death. A big change driving recent increases in the official numbers stems from the tendency to include more and more cancers related to pregnancy in maternal death rates. The study's authors calculated maternal death rates for the periods that the CDC did from 1999 to 2002 and 2018 to 2021 in two different ways, first by using the agency's methodology and then by restricting maternal deaths only to those whose pregnancy appeared at least once amid the causes of death on a death certificate. And initial filings for unemployment benefits in Massachusetts dropped last week compared with the week prior. New jobless claims, a proxy for layoffs, fell to 5,064 in the week ending March 9th, down from 5,434 the week before. U.S. unemployment claims dropped to 209,000 last week, down 1,000 claims from the week prior. Oregon saw the largest percentage increase in weekly claims. New Hampshire, meanwhile, saw the largest percentage drop in new claims, with claims dropping by 60.6%. So that's all the time I have for today. This is your reader, Beth, saying thanks for listening, and thank you for your continued support of the Audible Local Ledger.